From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
I lifted up the shirt a few inches and I observed two bullet holes to his lower midsection. I said, oh my God. And I just held him, his hand, I rubbed his face. Please.
Two New York City police officers charged with the murder of Amadou Diallo break their silence for the first time in the year on the stand. We'll go live to Albany for the trial. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Today is the day the U.S. prison and jail population is projected to reach 2 million for the first time. We turn now to Jason Zeidenberg, who's Justice Policy Institute's policy analyst. Jason, what's the significance of this day?
The significance of this day is that we're marking the fact that the world, that the U.S. now has the world's largest incarcerated population and the highest incarceration rate. And just a couple of weeks into the new millennium, America has the distinction of having a quarter of the world's prison population, despite only having 5% of the world's population. It's just huge numbers that we all need to be aware of.
And what does this mean for a voting population as we're in the midst of the primaries for president?
It's a good point. It hasn't come up in any of the election talk, but a significant part of the electorate, 10 to 14% of the African-American population has lost the right to vote in this country due to felony disenfranchisement, due to being incarcerated.
Jason Zeidenberg, thanks for being with us of the Justice Policy Institute in Washington, D.C. Again, the U.S. now having the world's largest incarcerated population and highest incarceration rate. Just 6 weeks into the new millennium, America has earned the distinction of having a quarter of the world's prison population, despite having less than 5% of the world's population. The debate over the Confederate flag atop the South Carolina State House now heads to a chamber beneath it. Governor Jim Hodges has unveiled a plan this week which would put the flag of the Army of Northern Virginia on a pole beside a statue of a horse-riding Confederate general. Hodges, who's a Democrat, also would remove the Confederate flag from within the House and Senate chambers, but preserve the names of streets and protect monuments named after Confederate war figures. The NAACP says Hodges' plan was floated several weeks ago, calling it unacceptable then when it was mentioned, and it's unacceptable, they said, today. Meanwhile, in Richmond, Virginia, the remaining renaming of two city bridges that honored Confederate generals J.E.B. Stuart and Stonewall Jackson has drawn criticism from the sons of Confederate veterans who say the change is an attack on their history. The Richmond City Council voted 7-0 to rename the bridges in honor of desegregationist lawyer Samuel Tucker and civic leader Curtis Holt. Prospects for a quick resumption of world trade negotiations dim today, with some leaders at a major UN conference in Bangkok, Thailand, warning of a backlash against economic globalization. Organizers of the UN Conference on Trade and Development meeting had hoped the gathering would resolve disputes that sank negotiations at last year's World Trade Organization summit in Seattle. The United States suffered a major embarrassment in Seattle when President Clinton was confronted by massive street protests and a revolt by developing countries over what they said were closed-door dealings by the major powers. About 500 Thai farmers demonstrated peacefully outside the conference site today, claiming trade liberalization will force them to become dependent on foreign markets, imported seeds, technologies, and chemicals. They presented a basket of organic vegetables to UNCTAD Secretary Ani Benham, who has received daily petitions from Thai protesters at the conference since it began on Saturday. Earlier today, 300 laid-off workers protested the Thai government's sale last year of 12 state-owned distilleries. The sale, which cost 10,000 jobs, was hailed by the IMF and foreign investors as evidence Thailand is committed to free markets and trade. The outgoing head of the IMF, Michelle Kamdisoos, was pied this weekend by protesters. Human rights investigators in Jakarta, Indonesia, have accused the Indonesian government today of failing to prosecute those responsible for committing atrocities in strife-torn Aceh province. Rosita Noor, a member of the Independent Investigative Commission of Human Rights Violations in Aceh, said that despite promises by the Indonesian president that he would crack down on people committing human rights abuses in Aceh, little has been done. Got milk? Dairy farmers say not if it's made from soy. The National Milk Producers Federation has filed a complaint with the Food and Drug Administration. It wants to stop beverages made from soybeans from being called soy milk. Under FDA standards, milk is the product of a cow. The American Soybean Association says it thinks people know the difference between cow's milk and soy milk.
Believe in freedom, cannot rest. We who believe in freedom cannot rest until it comes. We who believe in freedom, cannot rest. We who believe in freedom cannot rest until it comes.
You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. As soon as the trial of the four New York City police officers charged with the murder of Amadou Diallo begins, we will go live to Albany, New York. But now we will bring you excerpts of what happened yesterday. Breaking a year of silence, two New York City cops took the stand and gave their account of why they and two fellow officers fired the 41 bullets. The jury heard from the two officers who emptied the magazines of their semi-automatic weapons with 16 bullets each at Amadou Diallo on February 4, 1999. Officer Sean Carroll testified first. This is what he had to say on his cross, on his first, his direct, being questioned by his lawyer, John Patton.
Now, when you saw it was just a wallet, what, if anything, did you say or do?
I said, where's the f***ing gun? Where's the f***ing gun?
Was any of your brother officers there with you?
I'm not sure. I believe it might have been Kenny, but I'm not sure at that point.
Now, after you examined the wallet, what, if anything, did you do with the wallet?
At that point, when I realized it was not a weapon, I dropped it from my hand, started looking around. See if there, see where the weapon was. I went on from his right side. I crossed over closer to the rear door, and I did a quick search of the area for the firearm.
And did you find one?
No.
What did you next do?
I think I said something like, I seen muzzle flash. I seen the muzzle flash. At that point, the individual was still moving on the floor, and he was breathing. I told him, don't die. Don't die. Keep breathing. I can hear Kenny Boss on the radio calling for an ambulance. So I knew an ambulance was en route. Came a point where the individual stopped breathing. He stopped moving. At that point, I was holding his hands. Tell him to keep breathing. Just went to check his vitals. I was going to give him CPR. Put my hands on his chest. And I don't know if I pumped once. I don't even know if I pumped. I put my hands in the vicinity of his chest. And then I said, oh, God. Let me see how bad it is. If I start pumping on his chest, maybe I'm going to make it worse. At that point, I decided to lift up his shirt and to see if he was shot in the abdomen or just shot. I lifted up the shirt a few inches and I observed two bullet holes to his lower midsection. I said, "Oh my God." And I just held him, his hand, I rubbed his face. "Please.
And that was Sean Carroll, the first of the New York City police officers to testify about what happened on February 4th, 1999, and why he fired 16 shots from his semi-automatic weapon, requiring him to fire to press the trigger 16 times at Amadou Diallo. His attorney, John Patton, is an attorney who also represented one of the police officers charged with the torture of Haitian immigrant Abner Louima. He got his police officer off in that case. Sean Carroll was then cross-examined by the prosecutor, Donald Levin.
Do you believe that's the poster that you had in the car that night?
This is probably one. This is possibly one that was up in the front, and I had other ones in the back.
Is that the one related to the rapist, the serial rapist?
This is one of at least two, if not three, composite sketches that were issued to the street crime unit in regards to this rape pattern.
Okay. Isn't it fair to say that Mr. Diallo did not look at all like the serial rapist? Other than he was a male black, approximately 130 to 150 pounds.
On this particular photograph of the one that you handed me, there is a minimal resemblance to Mr. Diallo.
As a matter of fact, that would fit the description of numerous young males in the 4-3 precinct. Is that correct?
That I couldn't say.
You couldn't say that there are numerous young male blacks in the 4-3 precinct that would fit that description, 5'6 to 5'8, 130, 150 pounds?
I'm sure there are.
By the way, did you meet up with any supervisors that night?
The only supervisor that I ran into that evening was at muster, which was Lieutenant Pucci.
So you didn't see Lieutenant Cantwell during the course of the night?
No.
You didn't see Sergeant Patelli during the course of the night?
No.
Wasn't Sergeant Patelli at the Boynton Avenue job?
Oh, I'm sorry, yes. Yes. Sergeant Patelli was at the Boynton Avenue job. And possibly one of the other supervisors that I didn't recognize or don't recall seeing.
You're saying the man was looking up and down the street, is that correct?
Yes.
And looking up and down the street isn't a crime, is it, officer?
Absolutely not.
Do you know of any people that come home from a hard day's work and stay out in front of their house or on their porches and look up and down a block to see what's going on? Do you, sir?
I'm sorry, can you repeat the question, please?
Yeah, can we have it read back?
The fellow's chance on grounds of irrelevant.
Sustained.
Well, would you agree that Mr. Diallo was situated in a position where there was more light than where you and Officer McMillan were standing?
I'd say that's fair, yeah.
That's fair?
Sure.
You're out in the dark, right?
There are street lamps that are out in the street.
Right. Aside from the street lamps, you're out on the street in whatever light's on the street.
Sure. And you had the light from 1159 glaring out the door to it.
Right. And Mr. Diallo is by the vestibule wherein there is a light. Is that fair to say?
Well, like I said before, sir, the lighting conditions in this picture, as far as I recollect, are not properly depicted, and that the outside light, I'm almost positive, was off, and if there was an inside light on, it was very dim.
Were you able to make out Mr. Diallo's features from where you were standing and looking in?
At that point, it only looked like a male, which I couldn't tell whether it was Hispanic or black, wearing dark clothing and some kind of hat, wool hat.
Well, I think before you said Mr. Diallo resembled the rapist somewhat.
I said because of his height and approximate weight, there was a somewhere along the lines of he matched the description.
But you had no distinguishing features of his face to compare with that photograph or sketch of the rapist. Is that fair to say?
Sure.
But yet you maintain that he resembled the rapist to a certain degree.
He had certain physical characteristics that did match the rapist.
But certainly not of anything about his face.
No, nothing about his face.
So that if anyone was 5'6 to 5'8, 130 to 150 pounds, and you didn't see their face, nevertheless, you would stop them because you believe they were the rapist.
Sustained.
So by now, you're almost surely convinced he had a gun. Is that fair to say?
I thought maybe not a gun, but he definitely had a weapon in his right side.
And as you're running, is your partner yelling commands as well? Police, don't move, show us your hands, all those types of commands in a loud voice?
I believe Officer McMillan was saying, show me your hands.
And you, when you were rushing up to him, did you see his hand still in his pocket?
His right hand.
And are you concerned about that, weren't you?
Absolutely.
As a last, he wasn't obeying your commands. Is that what you're telling us?
He was not obeying our commands. That is correct.
As a last resort, is there any reason, as you're running up to this vestibule, to yell at him, stop or I'll shoot you? Are you telling us that you wouldn't go out of your training to protect life?
Objection, Your Honor. Argumentus.
Sustained.
Prosecutor Donald Levin, questioning, cross-examining the first of the police officers to take the stand yesterday in the Amadou Diallo murder trial. He is Sean Carroll. He fired 16 bullets at Amadou Diallo. We next go to the second police officer who testified, who also fired 16 bullets, Edward McMillan, as he was cross-examined by prosecutor Donald Levin.
You admit you fired your weapon on February 4th of 1999?
Yes.
And you admit you unloaded your weapon at Amadou Diallo?
I fired 16 times.
And you fired because you perceived he was firing a gun at you?
I thought he had a gun in his hand.
And that perception was a false one, wasn't it, Officer McMillan?
Objection to the term false.
Overruled. Sitting here today, yeah, I was wrong.
So you went over, stopped him, and frisked him?
We stopped him. Sean questioned him, and we frisked him for our own safety. Absolutely.
Right. You detained him for some period of time, is that correct?
Yes.
And did you put that in your memo book, that you had this police action?
I didn't put anything in my memo book that night.
And, again, the purpose of the memo book is to indicate what type of police action that you took. Isn't that fair to say?
Yes. That's the purpose of the memo book.
And aside from the four of you that night, nobody else was informed that this man was stopped, frisked, and detained. Is that correct?
Well, his friends would know.
Well, nobody in the police hierarchy would know about that. Is that correct?
No.
In other words, you didn't call it into Central and say we stopped and frisked an individual. Is that correct?
That wouldn't be procedure.
You didn't do that, right?
Oh, we didn't do that.
And you didn't notify Lieutenant Pucci that you had stopped and frisked somebody?
No.
And you didn't notify Sergeant Patelli? Is that correct?
Sergeant Patelli?
Yes.
No.
And you didn't notify Lieutenant Cantwell?
No.
So how would anyone know that you hadn't violated someone's rights unless you made an official record of this?
You're listening to the cross-examination of the second police officer to take the stand in the Amadou Diallo murder trial. He is Edward McMillan. We're going to go back to his testimony and then go live to the courthouse in Albany, where we expect the third police officer will take the stand today. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be back in a second. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers, as we continue our review of yesterday's testimony of the two police officers who testified, breaking their silence for the first time in a year since the February 4th, 1999 shooting of Amadou Diallo. Edward McMillan and Sean Carroll were partners, and they are the shooters who shot the most bullets at Amadou Diallo, both of them shooting 16 times. Edward McMillan, who we'll hear from again right now, has had five complaints filed against him with the Civilian Complaint Review Board alleging excessive force, abuse of authority, and racial insensitivity. The CCRB said none of the allegations were substantiated. We'll continue with the cross-examination of Edward McMillan.
Well,
it's argumentative, too.
There was no official record of this stop and frisk. Is that fair to say?
No.
The police department offers scenarios and role-playing, don't they?
In the academy, yes, we're trained in what they call the tactical house.
Exactly. If people pull innocuous objects on you, or they may pull a gun on you, and you have to make a determination whether, in fact, it's a gun or not.
But no, what they do is they pull guns that they're called starter pistols, which sound like a real gun, and they train you to not to shoot too fast, but not to shoot too late.
They tell you to assess the situation?
Absolutely.
Did you assess the situation that night while you were firing at Mr. Diallo?
Every step I assessed it.
You mean after each pull of the trigger, you stopped and assessed what was going on? And
no.
And then you pulled the trigger again?
No, it was every action Mr. Diallo took from the point when I first saw him to the point when I began to fire,
right.
I assessed his actions.
You consciously assessed his actions. Is that what you're telling us?
Yes.
Edward McMillan testifying yesterday, one of the three police officers. We're now going live to the trial in Albany, New York, where the third police officer is now on the stand. He is Kenneth Boss, who fired at Amadou Diallo five times.
Kenny, how old are you?
I'm 28.
And where do you live?
Suffolk County.
Where is Suffolk County?
It's a suburb of Long Island, about 50 miles east of New York City.
Are you married?
No, I'm not.
Who do you live with?
I live with my father.
Have you ever been married?
No, I haven't.
Kenny, where did you grow up?
In Suffolk County, on Long Island.
And where did you go to school?
To Sachem, the high school district there.
Kenneth Boss is being questioned
did
by his own attorney,
yes,
Stephen Brownstein.
What, if any, education did you receive after high school?
I never did. I just graduated high school. That was it.
After high school, what did you do, Ken?
I joined the Carpenters Union.
Where was that?
Long Island, New York City area.
What did you do as a carpenter?
Mainly sheetrock.
Did there come a time when you became a police officer?
Yes.
When was that?
I enrolled in the academy in January of 1992.
And Ken, did you have to take a pay cut when you became a police officer?
Yes, I did.
Where were you trained?
In the academy?
Yes.
The New York City Police Academy.
Prior to that, did you ever own or carry a gun?
No, I did not.
Just a couple questions about your training. How were you trained to react when you perceived a fellow officer or a citizen was facing a deadly threat?
If another officer or a citizen or myself was in imminent danger, I was trained to alleviate the threat and to do whatever I could to help.
Help who?
Whoever was in trouble.
Where was your first assignment as a police officer?
I was assigned to the transit police, and I was assigned to a transit district in Queens.
What's the transit police?
Well, at the time, now they're all one department. At that time, there were three separate departments. There were the transit police, we did the subways, that's where I was assigned, the housing police, and the New York City police.
Did there come a time when you switched over to the quote unquote, regular New York City Police Department?
Yes.
And when was that happening?
I came over to the NYPD in January of 94.
Did you have to receive any additional training when you did that?
I had to go back to the academy for 6 more weeks.
After you were graduated from the New York City Police Academy, where was your first assignment?
I was assigned to the 28th Precinct.
Where's that?
It's up in Harlem.
And what was your job? What did you do up there?
Excuse me. I was assigned to a training unit. In that precinct, some cops, a handful, and a direct sergeant. And we learned basic NYPD patrols, foot posts, driving around in radio cars, answering calls for help.
What type of actions did you deal with?
Everything. Domestic disputes, street violence, calls for help, cardiac arrests. All sorts of police work.
Ken, why did you become a New York City police officer?
Well, yeah, I wish I could say it was for the benefits or for the salary. I was making good money. I had good benefits. It was always something I wanted to do. It was something I felt I would be good at, I was good at, and that it was something I could do with honor and something I could be proud of.
After you left the 28th Precinct, where were you assigned?
I was transferred to the 75th Precinct in Brooklyn.
75th Precinct, specifically, what neighborhood is that?
It's East New York.
Can you give us a description of East New York?
East New York's mainly residential, high crime area, depressed. It's a precinct that's much in need of police.
How'd you like working in the 75th?
I loved it.
And where were you assigned specifically to in the 75th precinct?
When I got to the 75th precinct, I was assigned to the midnight shift doing uniform patrol.
What, can you tell us what you did in uniform patrol?
Again, you were assigned to a police car. We call them radio cars. You were assigned a sector designation. A precinct will be basically split up into sector designations, and you will be assigned that certain sector, and you're responsible for all calls for help or any need of police within that sector, along with any kind of backup you might have to do to aid additional sectors.
When you said you worked the midnight shift, what is the midnight shift?
Sometimes they're different, but the midnight shift for uniform patrol usually starts at 11:15 at night, and you work till 7:50 in the morning.
Did there come a time where you were transferred to another unit within the 75th precinct, Ken?
Yes.
And what unit was that?
I was transferred from patrol to the 75th anti-crime team.
What is the anti-crime team?
It's a patrol unit, but instead of being in uniform, you're in plain clothes. Instead of driving around in a marked police car, you're in an unmarked car. And instead of being assigned jobs over the radio from the dispatcher, you are there to support patrol by trying to identify the crimes before they happen and trying to, in other words, you're there to prevent 911 jobs. You're there to stop them before they happen.
What, if any, crimes were you particularly supposed to focus on?
Anti-crime was a large focus on robberies, on guns, burglaries, anything that would be designated as a major crime.
Ken, how many arrests have you made in your career? Felonies and misdemeanors combined.
Myself, personally, I have over 100 felonies, and then misdemeanors on top of that. I don't know how many.
What type of felony arrests?
That I've made?
Yeah.
Guns, robberies, rape, carjackings, shootings, stolen cars, anything that would fit into a felony.
Have you received any medals, honors, decorations, or commendations in conjunction with your work as a New York City police officer?
Yes, I have.
How many?
The last time I checked, it was on or near 50 times I've been decorated.
And of those 50 times, can you give us the description what you were decorated for?
Many of them were gun arrests. All of them were pickup felonies. Ed described what a pickup was yesterday. It's, in other words, instead of being assigned by the radio dispatcher, it's basically you identify something in progress, and you're able to identify it and make the apprehension. It's guns, robberies, street assaults, you know, stabbings, shootings, anything along those lines.
Did you ever receive a commendation known as the Cop of the Month?
Yes, I have.
What is the Cop of the Month?
What it is it's sort of the supervisors getting together and giving you recognition for a job well done. It's voted on. It's something that if you deserve the merit, they give it to you.
Have you ever been bestowed that honor?
Yes, I have.
When was that?
December of 98.
3 months before this incident?
Yes.
Did there come a time when you were transferred to the street crime unit?
Yes.
Was that done because you requested it or because you were drafted?
I requested
it. Where were you transferred to?
I was transferred from the 75th Precinct to the street crime unit, and I was assigned to the borough of the Bronx.
Had you ever worked in the Bronx before?
No, I haven't.
Briefly, because we've been through this, what does the street crime unit do?
Similar to the anti-crime designation I had explained before, what the street crime unit does is they're basically called in by the precincts to address any spikes in crime, any rise in shootings, or if there's anything that the street crime unit can do to help, to assist patrol.
Can you give me a description of the neighborhoods that you've been sent into as a street crime officer?
Well, the Bronx is a lot like Brooklyn. It's residential, and the layout's a lot the same. All the precincts that I was starting to get familiar with were all high crime areas. Again, like the 75th Precinct, they were all native police.
Ken, how many, as a street crime officer, when did you join the street crime again? I'm sorry.
It was either the first or second week in September of 98.
And how many illegal weapons did you seize as a street crime officer from September 1998 until February 1999?
My partner and I had 17 separate gun arrests.
Can you tell me what kind of weapons you seized?
Sure. The majority of them were small automatics. 25 caliber, 380, Mac 11 machine pistol, shotgun, 44 bulldog.
What's a 44 bulldog?
Well, that became famous with Son of Sam. That was a weapon Son of Sam used. I hate to use it. It's a snub nose. It's a smaller weapon, but a very large caliber.
You used the term small automatics. Can you tell me what a small automatic is?
Usually they're a smaller caliber, like a 25. It's the weapon of choice. It's the most common weapon you'll find. It's small. It's square. It's got a right angle to it. And easily secreted into a pocket, jacket pocket, pants pocket. They're lightweight and they're concealable.
What kind of weapon did you carry?
I had a Glock 9mm.
Did you have a choice in which weapon you can use?
No. When I received my training, the Glock was the only weapon we were issued.
And what type of ammunition or bullets were you given?
The full metal jacket, 9mm.
Again, was that something that you were required to carry?
Yes, I was issued.
Ken, were you familiar with street names and the directions in the Bronx in February 1999?
I had some familiarity with some of the precincts we had been in, but all in all, the Bronx was really new to me, and I didn't know much of it at all.
I want to direct your attention to February 3rd, 1999. Do you remember that day?
Yes, I do.
What time were you going to work, assigned to go to work?
That was a modified midnight shift. We started at 9:30 at night. We worked till 6 in the morning.
How were you dressed?
That night I was wearing blue jeans. I had a pink sweatshirt on, a flannel shirt, like a jacket with a hood on it, and I think it was a tan baseball hat.
What else were you wearing?
A bulletproof vest.
Your Honor, I'm going to ask that this be marked as defendant's you.
You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! As we broadcast live from the Albany, New York trial of the four police officers on trial for the murder of Amadou Diallo. The third police officer is now testifying. He is Kenneth Boss. He shot five times at Amadou Diallo, and he is now looking at a bulletproof vest.
Yes, I do.
What is it?
It's a bullet-resistant vest.
Is it the same or similar to the one you wore on February 3rd, 1999?
Yes, it is.
Your Honor, I'm going to ask for it to be admitted in evidence.
Show it to counsel.
Of course.
You was received.
Okay.
Wait a minute.
Yes, sir.
Let the court reporter mark it. He's got to mark it received.
To wear that?
Yes, we are.
Would you have worn it in any event?
Absolutely.
Ken, who were you assigned to work with on February 3rd, 1999?
It was myself, Sean Carroll, Rich Murphy, and Ed McMillan.
Who assigned you to work with these individuals?
We were assigned that through our supervisor when we arrived that night.
Had you ever worked with any of these individuals before?
Sure.
What time did you, where did you turn out from?
Randall's Island.
Try and cut through. You heard Mr. Carroll, Sean testify about incidents at Boynton Avenue, Bronx River housing, and a stop that was made earlier. Actually around 10:30, 11 o'clock in the evening. Do you remember those?
Yes, I do.
Was the information...
You are listening to the direct testimony of Kenneth Boss, the third police officer, who is now testifying in their own defense. Kenneth Boss shot five times at Amadou Diallo. He is being questioned by his own attorney, Stephen Brownstein. And we'll be back live from the courthouse in just a minute here on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman as we continue live with the trial. But before we go back to Kenneth Boss, who is testifying, just a reminder about who Kenneth Boss is. Just yesterday on Democracy Now! We had on the father of Patrick Bailey, Kenneth Boss, will not face federal civil rights charges in the 1997 fatal shooting of Patrick Bailey, Lloyd Bailey's son. He was 22 years old. He was shot by Kenneth Boss. Family attorneys say that Boss allowed Bailey to bleed to death. Bailey was shot from behind. Boss refused to talk to internal affairs investigators of the Brooklyn District Attorney, who issued a controversial report last year finding that the shooting had been justified because Bailey had been wielding a gun. His family is not convinced of this, and they are calling for a reopening of the investigation. Now, whether this will be introduced is another question. It all depends on whether it's introduced by the direct. Then the prosecutors could go for it. We go back now to the direct examination of Kenneth Boss, who shot five times at Amadou Diallo.
To a vestibule.
Do you know that address now?
Yes, that was 1157 Wheeler Avenue.
What was this person doing?
As far as I can see, he was standing there.
When you backed up, where did you back up to in relation to this person?
Well, I had backed up a little bit too far. I wasn't directly in line with him, meaning I didn't have... He wasn't in line with me. He was slightly ahead of me now. I had backed up a little bit further.
When you passed by, can you tell me what were the... Could you see the lighting conditions there?
Yes.
What were they?
The light was not substantial.
You know which light was on and which light was off?
No, I don't.
After you backed up, what happened?
I backed up. I stopped the car. At that time, Sean Carroll and Ed McMillan both got out of the car on the passenger side.
Where were they going?
They were going to talk to the person that I seen standing on the doorstep.
What did you do?
I stayed in the car.
By the way, Ken, where was your badge? Did you have a badge on?
Yes, sir.
Where do you wear it?
It was over the sweatshirt, but under the jacket was open, but it was... under the flannel.
When Sean and Ed approached, what, if anything, did you hear them say?
When I got out of the car and started walking, I heard, I don't know if it was Sean or Ed, but I heard two separate times, "Police, can I have a word?"
When you were in the car, were your windows open or closed?
My window on my side was open a crack.
And where were they walking to?
They were walking towards the sidewalk.
What happened as Ed and Sean approached?
While I was still watching on the doorstep, Ed and Sean, they walked around a parked car. They were heading for the sidewalk. As they got to the sidewalk, either they were just getting on it, maybe they were on a step, but they were in the vicinity of the curb. That's when I noticed from the doorstep where he was just standing, as I could see. I didn't have a clear view of him. As they got up, after they identified themselves and they were walking up, that's when I seen my now known name, Mr. Diallo, turn abruptly and dart back into the vestibule.
Could you see into the vestibule from where you were?
From where I was, no, I couldn't.
How come?
Well, the angle from where I was sitting in the car, I couldn't have visible access into the vestibule. I could see the front steps and the entranceway, but into the vestibule, I couldn't see.
Was there anything between you and the vestibule?
At that time, it was parked cars and also Sean and Ed.
Did there come a time when you heard something?
Yes. When Mr. Diallo darted back into the vestibule and Sean and Ed, where a second before they were just walking, and it was almost a casual thing. When he made the move, that's when they started running in towards him. I was able to see him go up the stairs, up into the stairs leading to the vestibule. I heard some loud voices.
When you say loud, you say loud voices?
Yeah.
Can you tell me... If from there, at that time, if you know what was said in voices?
I couldn't make out what was being said. I could hear the voices.
Where was Richie Murphy?
Richie Murphy, he didn't get out of the car with Sean and Ed. He got out somewhere, I would imagine, in that time. I just don't know when.
When you heard the voices, were you the only one in the car, if you know?
To my knowledge, I think I was, yes.
After you heard the loud voices, what did you do?
Well,
what did you hear?
What? I heard gunshots after that.
Were you in the car or out of the car when you heard the gunshots?
Once I seen that Sean and Ed were chasing them, it looked to me like it was going to be some sort of chase into a building. And I wasn't needed in the car anymore. So I was getting out of the car to help them in the pursuit. That was after I heard the yelling. And then I heard gunshots.
What did you do when you heard the gunshots, Ken?
I jumped out of the car. As I'm getting out of the car, it was just to me a chase right now. And then I hear the gunshots. I'm already out of the car, and I'm moving. I thought I was in a chase, and then I hear gunshots as I'm running along, trying to get between these cars, the parked cars, between myself and the vestibule. I heard shots. Started hearing more shots. At that time, I was able to see again towards the vestibule. I saw Ed McMillan. He was on the left side of the vestibule. Emerge and just come flying off that step all the way down. And at the same time, Sean Carroll is on the right-hand side, and he's coming down the stairs. It was frantic. He was running down the stairs, and it was just it was intense. He was just doing whatever he could to retreat off those stairs, and Ed was on the ground. The shots are still going off. I'm running. I'm moving. And Ed was shot. That's all I could see. Ed was firing his weapon. Sean was firing his weapon into the vestibule. I came running up. I came running up to Ed. I tried to get to Ed. He's at this time, he's on the sidewalk. His legs are in front of him. His torso was up, a little slightly back, but up. He had his left hand on the sidewalk with his feet in front of him, and he was pushing himself away from the stairs. And he was firing his weapon into the vestibule. I rushed up. I wanted to get Ed. But as I came up, I couldn't see into this vestibule until I got almost behind Ed. I look up into the vestibule. Seconds ago, it was just a man standing there. Now it was an intense situation. I look into the vestibule where Ed is firing. I can see he's firing. He's pushing himself away. And then I see Mr. Diallo. He's in the rear of the vestibule, in the back, towards the back wall where that inner door is. He's a little bit off to the side of that door, and he's crouched. He's crouched, and he's got his hand down. And I see a gun. And I said, oh my God, I'm going to die. I fired my weapon. I fired it as I was pushing myself backwards. And then I jumped off to the left. I was out of the line of fire.
Ken, when you hear the gunshots, how fast were you moving?
I never stopped. It was, I just leaped from the car and I was running. I was running while it was happening. And all I could think was, I got to get Ed McMillan out of there. He's shot. He's down.
Why did you think you had to get out of there?
He's down. He's shot. Somebody's got to get him out.
Could you see, when you were approaching Ed, what could you see Sean doing?
Most of my focus was on Ed McMillan, but I was able to see Sean Carroll. Again, Ed was down and on the left. If you were looking straight in, he was on the left-hand side. Sean Carroll was on the right-hand side. Off the parapet, is that how it's been described? Off to the right side, near that parapet.
Ken. Approaching.
You're listening to the live trial of the four white New York City police officers charged with second-degree murder in the shooting death of Amadou Diallo, who died last February 4th, 1999. Kenneth Boss is being questioned by his own attorney, Stephen Brownstein, as he lays out his story. We only have a few minutes, but we are breaking away from the testimony to get some analysis on what we've heard over the last 2 days. Again, Kenneth Boss, the third of the four police officers to testify. Tomorrow, we will be bringing you. Today, we will be bringing you. Tomorrow, some of that testimony, more of Kenneth Boss, as well as the fourth police officer, Richard Murphy. We now turn to Graham Weatherspoon. Graham Weatherspoon is a retired police detective with the New York City Police Department. He represents 100 blacks in law enforcement who care.
Good morning,
Amy. Welcome to Democracy Now, Graham.
Thank
what
you.
Is your assessment so far? We've heard now three police officers describe what happened.
Well, let me go back to yesterday. I'm not satisfied with the prosecution in this case. They're doing a very sloppy job. Mr. Levin apparently does not know how to word his questions or rephrase the questions following the sustained objections by the judge. And we saw him yesterday. He failed to attack Ms. Elliott on the stand as a witness. There is conflicting information that she gave relative to this incident with regard to the officers. She said they never ascended the stairs. They said they did. If the jury is to deal with Ms. Elliott, they must consider her to be a truthful witness. That does not exist. With regard to Mr. Carroll, he was very sterile. He used military terms. He spoke of mustering the troops.
Sean Carroll being
the first of the officers to
testify, and he fired 16 shots.
Yes, he spoke of mustering the troops. He continued, let me back up. The prosecution never got, they never placed Mrs. Diallo on the stand to get a picture of Amadou Diallo, the victim, whose only brittle body can speak for him at this point. She should have been the first one on the stand. Secondly, they should have produced the Sprint report relative to this investigation. The Sprint report is a computer printout of the 9/11 calls and also the transmissions coming over the radio from the police offices. I talk with a number of people in this area, and there is a big gap in time between the shooting and the first officers to respond to this matter. The Sprint report would tell us exactly who made the initial call, whether it was a 9/11 coming from a neighbor or the police officers themselves. That was not produced in this case. What is the conviction rate of these officers who talk of their stellar careers? Most of the street crime arrests, and I've talked with assistant DAs in the Bronx and Brooklyn, and they said when they would get a case coming in from street crime, their attitude was, oh, here we go with another one. Many of their cases are dismissed and thrown out because of violations of search and seizure.
I wanted to read you a quick comment. Juan Gonzalez's piece, my co-host on Democracy Now!, writes for the New York Daily News in today's Daily News, Who's Suspicious? And he ends by saying, as Prosecutor Don Levin asked, didn't Diallo have reason to be afraid of the four men? Most important in his cross-examination, Levin asked both Carroll and McMillan if they ever considered whether Diallo spoke any English and understood what they were saying, if it occurred to them that he might be deaf, if they ever considered that he was mentally disturbed, or if they ever thought of backing up and seeking cover. They answered no to each question. To the four cops on Wheeler Ave, a young black man ducking into his vestibule away from them must be up to no good. His reaching into his pocket must be for a gun. If this jury accepts such logic, God help us all.
Most definitely.
But it was very emotional testimony that we heard from Sean Carroll as he broke down on the stand yesterday. And as his defense attorneys are trying to put forward, this is a tragedy, not a crime. Do you think they've been successful so far in putting forward that theory?
You know, unfortunately, we can't see the faces of the jury in this trial, and they are the ones who are going to determine whether or not this is a tragedy or a crime. So it's hard to say. Personally, I'm not buying the story from the officers.
But do you think that the defense has done a good job, which would lead us to think that we're going in the direction of acquittal?
No, even with Sean Carroll's tears yesterday, Sean Carroll is very sterile. He's very clinical in his approach to this scenario.
Do you think the prosecution successfully got at any issues that would lead the jury to believe this wasn't just a tragedy?
Well, one of the things that Sean Carroll said was, I shot the best that I could. He did say that. He also said that my bullets didn't appear to affect him. That's another thing. It's inconceivable that you can fire 8 rounds into somebody's side and it doesn't affect them.
We also heard them say, Edward McMillan, that they said something along the lines of, please, sir, can we have a word with you? Is this realistic? You're
not,
a former detective.
Not at all. Not at 2 o'clock in the morning. You're going to say something to the effect of, police, don't move. Put your hands up. Let me see your hands. And another thing is that they keep, McMillan said he had a gun. These guys keep saying he had a gun. And there was no objection by prosecution to that. They keep reinforcing the fact that Amadou Diallo, they have said, I saw a gun.
Mm-hmm.
I saw, there was no weapon in this case. And for them to use their weapons in a scenario like this, also, they can be charged with criminal use of a firearm, because when you use your weapon during the commission of a crime, you can be prosecuted for the criminal use of a firearm and criminal possession of a weapon. They conflicted their own training.
Well, we have to wrap up here. We also want to thank Court TV for providing us with the sound today. Graham Weatherspoon, retired police detective, New York City Police Department. He's with 100 Blacks in Law Enforcement Who Care. We'll be back with the Diallo trial tomorrow. Democracy Now! Is produced by Maria Carrion and David Love. Errol Maitland is our technical director. We'd like to hear from you. Our email address is democracy@pacifica.org. That's democracy@pacifica.org. From the studios of WBAI in New York, I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!